genre.
The Doctor's Companion presents Doctor Who The Long Way Round, the weekly podcast where we review and discuss every episode of Doctor Who, one doctor at a time. I'm Cass Fredrickson.
I was gonna try and come up with like a Valyard like alternate identity. I'm Nick Jimenez.
And I am Scott Carelli.
Oh, today on the show, we'll be discussing the conclusion of The Trial of a Time Lord with Terror of the Vervoids and The Ultimate Foe, the Sixth Doctor's 10th and final story, televised story.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And what a story, folks. What a...
Jesus.
What a thing.
Can I ask the dumb question first? And like, skipping to the very end of Ultimate Foe. Uh-huh. So like, you know, there was a moment when, you know, watching Ultimate Foe as the plot was climaxing, I was like, oh my gosh, am I about to watch Six regenerate or die? Mm. You know, because I knew going in, oh, this is his last televised story. So I feel like I've been told this years ago and kind of knew this once, but so is there any kind of reference? Does Sylvester McCoy, I've seen that episode. So, like,
yeah.
Did that, I guess, refresh my memory? Does he just waltz out of the TARDIS already, Sylvester McCoy?
He wears a yellow clown wig and Sixth Doctor's outfit, and he's rolled face down on the floor of the TARDIS, and they roll him over, and then he's already regenerating into Sylvester McCoy.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was that episode called?
Time and the Ronnie.
Oh, okay, of course. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Extremely disrespectful, if I do say so.
Well,
but it is Colin. It is at least partially Colin Baker's fault, that's what they had to do. I will get to that, after a long winded, background and significance to this.
I think it's safe to say throughout now watching these two stories that I think Six is the most disrespected doctor.
Oh yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. Just like kind of across the board. I mean,
he's done dirty. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like he just, you know, he was given a bunch of stories that like shouldn't have went to him, you know, like just because it's what Eric Saward wanted to write, with no thought to who was playing the doctor, and what kind of doctor he should be. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's a complicated thing. But he did eventually get his regeneration story in the form of a Big Finish audio adventure, which eventually we will get to.
cool.
Eventually down the line. Mm-hmm. We will not be covering all of Colin Baker's Big Finish. I've sort of constructed a best of kind of situation for the remainder of his run. Because why would we want to listen to bad ones? I should have been doing that with the Eighth Doctor from the beginning. I don't know. I wish there's so many stories that I wish we had not listened to. but you know, live and learn. But going forward, all Big Finish audios will be a little more hand chosen rather than just the next one.
Have either of you ever gone back and listened to our Minuet in Hell episode?
Oh my God, no.
Yes.
How drained. I have.
I listened to it when we put it up on, when I put everything up on YouTube.
Oh, on YouTube.
Yeah. Because I had to delete that. That one had our old theme song with the Muse song in it.
Copyrighted,
so I had to I had to replace that in order to get it up on YouTube.
So that was like the fourth time you've edited that, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yes, indeed. Indeed, indeed. So, yeah, I don't want that to happen again. So going forward, Big Finish will be much more of a best of situation. So we will eventually get to his regeneration story. It was finally produced in 2015. So we will get there, but, it also, pays off, the thing at the end of this, story, which is never paid off in the show, which is the Valeyard still being around and cackling directly at the camera. talk to us in, I don't know, 2030, whenever we get around to that.
That sounds fake, Scott.
For its 15th anniversary of release.
Wow.
Yeah.
He seems so primed for a revival, though, in the wake of the game, the Toymaker. And
I mean, I tend to agree, and people are always like, oh, is this going to be the Valeyard? Oh, are they finally going to do the Valeyard? That happens a lot. He's constantly kind of coming back up in fan circles as rumors. I remember, if I'm not mistaken, there was like a rumor originally that Sasha Dewan was going to be the Valeyard, and then it ended up just being the Master again. Everyone was like, okay, I guess it's just the Master again.
The Mephisto of Doctor Who.
Yeah, I think totally. It's either the Valeyard or the Rani. One or the other is definitely the Mephisto. The problem with the Valeyard is that the Valeyard is very confusing in terms of like how you make it work or why or where or when or
especially now.
But like even then, it's like, well, you're not going to get this guy to play him again. So then it's like. So now the Valeyard is going to be played by a different. So now it's a different. Well, what the hell is that about?
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. It's very confusing.
I remember, and obviously I didn't have the context for it at the time, but in watching Ultimate Foe, I kind of vaguely remembered some fan theories about there was speculation about how much Peter Capaldi resembled the Valeyard in appearance, and because he was going to be the 12th Doctor.
Right. That definitely came up there. It also came up when Metacrisis Doctor happened in, you know, the clone, the clone that goes off to live happily ever after with Rose. There was a long rumor that he was going to eventually come back and David Tennant would play the Valeyard, and that's who the Valeyard was that guy. And that's why it's confusing, because he is a later incarnation technically, but also isn't really. Yeah. So there was that. And then again, it happened now, because now there's rumors that the 14th Doctor will eventually become the Valeyard.
So still David Tennant.
Still David Tennant. Yes. So, you know,
I hope they both become different Valeyards.
Yes, I agree. I think that is what they should do. Lots of confusing. So I'm curious, Nick, like, before I get into all the background of all of this.
Yeah, and you have quite a bit.
Yeah, you just watched the final six episodes of The Six Doctors' televised adventures.
Mm-hmm. And 78 ads.
And 78 ads, because you watched it on Tubi. Mm-hmm. I almost recommended, because I don't think I've mentioned this on TDC yet, but if you watch it in a browser with an ad
you
blocker,
have. Yeah,
I don't know if it's on TDC or if I mentioned that on Dueling Genre Tonight.
I think that's
I talked to
was,
you so
yeah.
many times a week.
Yeah,
that I don't know where it came up, but yeah, if you watch it on a browser with an ad blocker, you don't get any ads on Tubi at all,
for sure. So, and it's my own stubbornness of wanting to watch it from the comfort of my couch, you know, with my TV. Yeah,
I know. I was typing up. I was like, well, to save yourself some time, because Nick was running a little late today. I was like, to save yourself some time, you could watch it with an ad blocker on your browser. And I went to hit enter and I was like, he's not going to do that. And I just deleted it.
I hit six in a row at one point, and that was.
Damn, that's a lot.
Yeah. Because yeah. I just know you like
my Hobbit.
You
know, kind you're, of, you're, yeah, yeah, comforts.
You just like the way that you do things.
Yes. Thank
yes.
You. Yeah. Thank you for accepting.
And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to respect that. I'm going to respect his choice, and I'm just going to let him watch it the way he wants to watch it.
It probably did add like half an hour to the overall experience, you know?
Yeah.
But hey, I mean, it's Tubi. You kind of get what you pay for, which is nothing.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true. It is true.
But thank
so
you.
So what were your thoughts on the final six episodes of Trial of a Time Lord?
You know, as listeners, you know, I had kind of a morning this morning. I was slow to rise. And, you know, I was like, oh my God, I have six episodes of Colin Baker to watch. but you know, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, like, should we, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then as I was wrapping up, even like as I was starting Ultimate Foe, I was like, oh, I get why Scott scheduled it this way. It was really cool to just watch it all conclude. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I thought about how plot centric early Who is, in stories compared to new Who. Like, there's really very little, to my knowledge, there aren't a lot of Doctor Who episodes even trying to do what stuff like Listen does later on in the show's history. Mm-hmm. So moments where it kind of seemed like this story was exploring the Sixth Doctor's like psyche and character and what his values were and what his like nature is, I found all that really pretty cool. And to say nothing of the fun like murder mystery party that happened way before that.
Yeah, with the vegetable guys.
Yeah, have they ever come back, the Vervoids?
No. No, they should, though. They're a great design, I think.
I love the design. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I love
it. Oh, no. Cass doesn't agree.
Cass is making a face. I think they hate the Vervoids. You don't like the Vervoids?
They look very phallic.
For sure. Yeah.
And I actually don't care for the Vervoids, no.
Oh, I mean,
I like the camaraderie.
Yeah.
There's a moment where they're carrying a body, and one Vervoid says to another Vervoid, "Help me with this." I was like, huh.
I don't know. I guess they do look kind of phallic. I don't know. But like, so do xenomorphs and,
yes.
I don't know. It feels like par for the course with monsters sometimes.
Or space, I guess.
Yeah, or space. Yeah. Look, everybody's afraid of dicks. Everybody.
That's what Giger always said.
Yeah. But in a German act.
Everyone's afraid of dicks.
I should not have taken a sip of water.
I mean, you didn't know. Yeah. So, Cass, how were you feeling revisiting the end of Colin Baker's run?
This one is kind of a mixed bag. I knew that going in. I had fun with Terror of the Vervoids for the most part. And I'd forgotten how convoluted the wrap-up to this story is. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have fun recapping that later. I mean, you're going to talk about it in the background, but like, I wish that the last part of this was better. Mm-hmm. And like, it's a bummer that we will never see the intended, like, actual final part of this.
Right.
I don't know. I really like the Valyard as a character and a concept. And like, I now, especially post like Timeless Child, it's like, well, the Doctor doesn't, and post Capaldi, it's like, well, the Doctor doesn't have like a finite amount of regenerations anymore. So mm-hmm. like, you'd have to completely reimagine or kind of figure this character, like we were talking about earlier. And then like, at what point does that like, because then it's just like basically the Master, you know, I don't know.
Right.
So, but I think it's really cool, like the concepts they were playing with at this point in time and how they were kind of digging more into like Time Lord lore and like how the Doctor, like the dichotomy of this character, like the Doctor, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I also just think, you know, my thing with this story, and I think the reason why I like Terror of the Vervoids as much as I do, is because I think it's the only story, and it's not his best story, right? But it's the only story, I think, in his entire run that knows how to use Six properly. Like, you know, his relationship with Mel is similar to his relationship with Perry, which is like that, you know, he's constantly annoyed by her, right? But what I like about his relationship with Mel is that he hides that from her, because he's like, oh, well, I don't want to be mean. Like, I don't want to be rude to her, but like, oh my God, I don't want to exercise. I don't want to drink carrot juice. This is so annoying. But instead, but he's lost like a lot of his arrogance, you know? And so he's a much softer character, I think, in Vervoids. And his relationship with Mel is much softer. And I just, so there's something about that that I really like. Even if the story is like just like kind of standard Doctor Who, like it's fine, you know?
Right.
But it meanders quite a bit. But I think that the balance and you know, it just felt like they were finally understanding him. And then now he's gone.
Right.
And it's unfortunate.
But like, I don't know, at the same time, and I like the structure of the trial being kind of like a Christmas Carol, like Ghost of Past, Present, and Future thing. Yeah. But I feel like all of that character development, like I feel cheated of not being able to see all of that character development where he's suddenly like, you know, he's like kinder and like a little more, like he's still Six, but he's not as abrasive.
Right.
You know? And like that was, if I'm remembering correctly, like that was the plan. That was like kind of the concept for his character, like going in, like he was going to be like this like rude, abrasive person and then kind of like develop, but like the development never really happens. And then it's just like, oh, now we're in the future. So like, this is a thing that happened.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think, you know, it, that arc is ultimately executed in his Big Finish story.
Yes.
Because, after this, you know, he, after the trial, he takes Mel back home because he isn't supposed to meet her yet. So he takes her back home and then leaves and goes off and learns and grows with a new companion and, you know, figures things out, before eventually circling back to Mel when he's supposed to meet her, which is when Terror of the Vervoids takes place, is after that point. So it's a little timey-wimey in that. Mel is the only other companion other than River Song that he meets out of order. So that kind of makes her a little interesting, I guess. But, yeah, I don't know. I agree with you, Cass. But at the same time, it's like, I don't know. I don't know how they would have continued with her.
Right.
After this. That's the confusing part. But in any event, I am sad that he does not have a TV story that I love. He only has TV stories that like I like or tolerate or despise. And
like 13.
That's really too bad. So anyway.
I also found Mel and Six's chemistry to be a highlight in Terror of the Vervoids. It's a shame. I don't know. Mel's just kind of like with Perry, there was always this really uncomfortable, like prisoner vibe of like her just being strung. And Mel just from the beginning just seems more like a firecracker that the doctor can like barely contain. And
yeah,
I think that counters his Sixness well.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Can't wait to hear all the background you have on this guy.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, speaking of Mel, we're going to start there. First of all, Trial of a Time Lord, parts 9 through 14, began airing 1st of November, 1986 and ended the 6th of December, 1986. Terror of the Vervoids, written by Pip and Jane Baker. We'll get to them later. And The Ultimate Foe was written by Robert Holmes, episode one of The Ultimate Foe, written by Robert Holmes and Eric Sayward, and episode two, written by Pip and Jane Baker.
Wow.
And the whole thing was directed by Chris Klow, all six episodes. So starting off with Melanie Bush, Perry Brown was dead.
To begin with.
yes, to begin with. see, that's great because this is a Christmas Carol ref.
Yeah.
it works. So, yes, Perry Brown was dead to begin with, and a new companion was required. Producer John Nathan Turner and script editor Eric Sayward developed Melanie Bush, a computer programmer from West Sussex. Sayward intended for Mel to have a strong feminist streak that would ultimately come and go, depending on the situation, while J&T insisted she should be redheaded and into fitness and healthy eating.
I noticed that. I think this was also the era when, like, Snoopy was doing aerobics.
Oh, yeah. This was, like, the, like, Jane Fonda aerobic, 80s
for sure.
Aerobics. Yeah. And, like, and not just that, but, like, because that was a big thing in America because of... Nancy Reagan was like pushing it. Like that was her big like right. agenda when she was first lady was like getting kids to stop being overweight and exercising.
Watching G.I. Joe, eating beef jerky and cereal.
Yeah, she was extremely fat phobic and was determined. She was like, you know, pushing the food pyramid and aerobics and, you know, making gym requirements and like all of that stuff and like all of those you know, like, oh, you got to run the mile when you're like 15 or whatever. Like all that shit came from Nancy Reagan. And then it was so ubiquitous in popular culture that it just like it like bled overseas as well. And then all of that led to Melanie Bush making the Six Doctor drink carrot juice on a bicycle. So she would also be the first purely British companion since 1976, because ever since the departure of Sarah Jane Smith, the Doctor had only traveled with aliens, Australians, and Americans.
a return to good, proper British Doctor Who companions.
Indeed. But yeah, I mean, the first British Doctor Who companion in a decade. That's kind of wild, to be honest. So then, as we've referred to, you know, with the third part of Trial of a Time Lord being a story from the Doctor's future in the structure of A Christmas Carol, Melanie would be introduced as a future companion. And as a result of the decision, Mel's first adventure with the Doctor would never be depicted. Although the character's proposal mentioned an incident in which she helped prevent the Master from using a computer network to commit massive worldwide bank fraud.
Wow.
That's how she met the Doctor.
she was just at work and she was like, hang on.
Yes, right. Yeah.
What's this guy trying to do?
The Master had the... what was it? The Superman 3 plan?
The Richard Pryor. Yeah.
Yeah. Taking cents from like every transaction, like a penny from every transaction in the world, and becoming a millionaire overnight as a result. And then, something that would, you know, these elements are important to point out because they add up. To a very dramatic result. But John Nathan Turner ultimately cast Bonnie Langford in the role without Eric Sayward's consultation or approval. Absolutely no discussion with Eric Sayward whatsoever. Was just told, oh, Bonnie Langford's going to play Mel. And he was like, cool, great, thanks.
You know, Cass has been pointing this out pretty much every week at this point, but again, it must be repeated. What were they doing over there?
Right?
I don't know. It gets okay. So much worse next. So much worse. With the development of Terror of the Vervoids, in an attempt to get as many first nights as possible on the season schedule, first nights being that the fact that like the first episode in a serial tends to have a higher number of people tune in because it feels like a jumping on point. So in order to get as many of those as possible, it was decided that the final six episodes of Trial of a Time Lord would be comprised of three two-part serials, with the first pair being linked by taking place in the same location with the same sets. Writers David Hallowell and Jake Trevor Story were hired to develop the stories, both veteran writers from veteran writers in television, but newcomers to Doctor Who. While David Hallowell progressed quickly on his story called Attack from the Mind, Jack Trevor Story struggled with his serial, The Second Coming. In Attack of the Mind, the TARDIS lands on this planet called Fred, where tunnels are being excavated by rodent-like natives, plagued by vivid mirages. When the Doctor and Mel are captured by the Freds, the Doctor is freed by these other people called Penelopeans, who are able to dwell within their own imagination. They are non-corporeal. And it turns out that they are responsible for the rodent Freds. That's what they're called. The rodent Freds, vivid mirages that they're constantly seeing. They're like fucking with them. And
the rats, they're giving the rats mirages.
Yes. Well, they're like people, rat rodent like natives.
Okay. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Called Freds. And yeah, so the hallucinations are like their defense system against them. And yeah, one thing leads to another, essentially. And it turns out that the Penelopeans have just been like toying with the Freds, who are largely a peaceful race out of boredom. And the Doctor and Mel convince them to go to war with each other. And then they bail. They're like, they just leave, leave them behind for the, non-corporeal, imagination monsters, to fight the poor, tunnel digging rodents. So wow. Yeah,
they would call it the Dream War.
Yeah. That's no, wild. Instead it's Attack from the Mind.
Attack from the Mind. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. That's so that's form? that was one two-part story that was so that was one of them. And then The Second Coming, the plot of that is largely unknown, but Story had a lot of difficulty understanding how to write for Doctor Who. Sayward recalled Story becoming fixated on specific details, such as an image of a man playing a saxophone inside a gasometer. No idea what the plot of this story was, but that's kind of the only thing that we know about it. There's a guy with a saxophone inside a gasometer. Ultimately, after five drafts of each story, Sayward abandoned both, rejected them in favor of a future segment returning to the four-part structure. So they did five drafts of this, and then he fired them both.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So then we move on to the production team approaching former script editor Christopher Bidmead to write the third trial segment, having most recently contributed The Hollows of Time, which was one of the casualties of BBC's directive to overhaul the original plans for this season. Originally, it was just going to be a bunch of, again, two-part, 45-minute episode stories like it was in the previous season. And then when they asked them to go back to 25-minute episodes, that's when they came up with the idea for the Trial of Time Lord, and they threw out everything that they had been working on. And one of those stories was The Hollows of Time by Christopher Bidmead, which would have featured the Doctor and Perry meeting with an AI researcher named Foxwell and his associate Professor Stream, as they began experimenting with linking human minds and turning them into a biological computer in hopes that the results could help them develop artificial intelligence, with Professor Stream ultimately being revealed to be the master in disguise. Stream master.
Boo.
Yep. Mm-hmm. yep, indeed. However, for the third portion of Trial of a Time Lord, Bidmead's adventure was a story called Pinakathika, which was about a planet which serves as a museum of key times and places in the history of the universe.
The Panacathea. I think that's the MacGuffin and Dial of Destiny.
Oh, yeah, because it was based on a Greek thing. So, yeah, that makes sense. Okay. All right. Yeah. So, anyway, that was going to be the story.
it checks out. We saw it in Indiana Jones movie.
Yeah. Bidmead corresponded regularly with Sayward because he wanted to make sure. He was like, I know we're on a tight schedule, so I'm gonna be in contact with you all the time. I'm going to be passing you pages. We're going to be going through this together. We're going to get this done. I'm in it to win it. Let's do this. And he was shocked when in early February 1986, after two drafts and a month of complete radio silence, he was contacted by John Nathan Turner who rejected Bidmead's scripts due to Eric Sayward calling them boring and unusable.
He didn't give notes to this guy. He made his boss do it.
No. He did give notes through the whole process. And then he turned in January at the first of the year, he turned in his second draft of this story only for a month later for John Nathan Turner to fire him.
Oh my God.
Yes. Next up on the list. Sayward contacted Sapphire and Steel creator P.J. Hammond, who quickly began writing a story called Paradise 5, in which the Dr. and Mel uncover a conspiracy involving a vast holiday complex on a pleasure world where people are disappearing and every vacationer had won their trip at the last minute, ultimately learning that Paradise 5 is a slave trading operation for an alien race. When they realize these slave-owning aliens cannot hold their physical form in high temperature, Mel leads an aerobics class that ultimately kills them and saves the day.
Like Snoopy.
She aerobics them to death.
What's interesting, though, is that there are morsels of that I think do come over to Terror of the Vervoids, even if that's purely coincidental.
It's purely coincidental, weirdly, because I will get to it, but that is weirdly purely coincidental. This time, however, it was not Eric Sayward, but in fact, John Nathan Turner, who was unhappy with the results of these scripts, and Hammond's script was dropped towards the end of February. Then, on March 1st, Nathan Turner ran into Pip and Jane Baker in a lift at BBC Television Center, and the Bakers had written 1985's The Mark of the Rani and had briefly been tasked with a story entitled Gallifrey for season 23, which may have, rumor has it, they never wrote it. It was just a proposal, but it was meant to be the season finale of season 23, and may have involved the destruction of the Doctor's home planet, which we would circle back on a few decades later. It was rendered defunct by the development of the trial storyline. Nathan Turner had been trying to contact the Bakers regarding the future segment, but they had only just returned from a lengthy holiday in Spain. So Nathan Turner explained the situation on the spot, and they agreed to meet with Sayward immediately. The script editor, however, was not enthusiastic about working with the Bakers again, who he hated and thought were terrible writers. He thought they were a nightmare to work with. However, they had a reputation for writing quickly, and so he proposed that they develop a mystery in space because, good God, how do you screw that up? and that the final episode should end with the Valyard placing the Doctor in terrible danger, which Nathan Turner thought might involve an accusation of genocide. So, over the weekend, the Bakers formulated a potential storyline with an Agatha Christie-style homicide taking place aboard a luxury transport. With the Baker's quick work proving acceptable, the scripts were commissioned under the title The Ultimate Foe, which really just goes to show you that the title is absolute meaningless garbage, that it was going to be the name of Terror of the Vervoids. And then they were like, oh, let's just bump that over to the next one. Who gives a shit?
I like it for the next one because it's like, you know, his ultimate foe is himself, Scott.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That is true. So on March 13th, they start writing, and and like Bidmead, the Bakers attempted to work very closely with Eric Sayward to try to avert any major problems. But he hated their scripts and he hated the writing and so much that by the time April 2nd rolled around, Sayward walked into John Nathan Turner's office and said, "I quit." And so he resigned from Doctor Who, with his duties on the Bakers episodes being ultimately performed by John Nathan Turner. More on Eric Sayward very soon. This is also around the time when it was decided that the final six episodes of Trial of a Time Lord would essentially, while they would be two separate stories, it was decided to group them together as serial 7C for production purposes. And so both stories shared the same crew and director. Moving on to the ultimate foe, all the way back to the concept meeting for Trial of a Time Lord, Sayward was, you know, at the time was working with Robert Holmes. He had agreed to write the first and final stories of the season to both start and end the storyline. But when his first story, The Mysterious Planet, was met with detailed and highly negative notes from BBC head of drama Jonathan Powell, Holmes, who was now in very bad health, was greatly demoralized by Powell's comments and was frustrated by the prospect of having to put Time Inc., which was what the final story was originally entitled, on hold while he revised The Mysterious Planet. Consequently, it was not until March that Holmes was able to begin work on the season's climactic story, now retitled The Fantasy Factory. At a certain point, too, they were like thinking about, well, maybe we'll just get Robert Holmes to write the third story as well. But with his like redrafting of Mysterious Planet and the fact that like he was getting ill and he still had to write the final story, they were like, there's no way we're going to be able to get another 4-part story out of this guy. So that didn't end up working out. Holmes completed a first draft of episode 13, part one of The Ultimate Foe. In his version of the opening installment, the Doctor encounters a character called Ben Cray inside the Time Lord Matrix. He is the assistant to J.J. Chambers at the Fantasy Factory, who was aware of and commented upon his artificial nature in like a metatextual way. The Doctor then encounters the Duke of Clarence and James Kenneth Stephen, who accused him of being Jack the Ripper, when in reality both men had been candidates for the infamous serial killer's true identity. At the episode's cliffhanger, the Doctor was thrown off a wharf by the Duke and apparently drowned. Eric Sayward had absolutely no idea what the next part of the story was going to be. None whatsoever.
Yeah.
Him crawling out of that wharf, presumably. I don't know where any of this is going. Suddenly Jack the Ripper is a part of this, and I don't know what's going on. because like before he could start on episode two, Holmes lapsed into a coma and then passed away 2 months later. So he had only written this, and Eric Sayward had no idea what was supposed to happen next. But he did ultimately agree to take over the unfinished scripts on the condition that John Nathan Turner would impose no large-scale changes to the storyline. Since the latter stages of episode 13 were still in rough shape, all the stuff that I described, he went and made a bunch of amendments because he was like, I don't know what any of this means. I don't know where it was going. I don't know how to wrap this up with this stuff. So he dropped the Jack the Ripper stuff, replaced the Doctor's drowning with the Valyard's quicksand trap. Ben Cray was revised to become Mr. Popplewick, who at the time Sayward envisioned as a gaunt old man in the tradition of Ebenezer Scrooge. And then the Valyard was established to be the Doctor's final incarnation. And then he scripted episode 14 from scratch. His version of the script began with the Master saving the Doctor from the quicksand while the Valyard kidnapped Glitz. The Doctor encountered Popplewick again, who led him into a trap baited with an illusion, the illusion of Melanie Bush. Popplewick was revealed to be a construct created by J.J. Chambers, who was unmasked as the Valyard. The Master reveals that the Valyard had materialized his TARDIS around a time vent in the Matrix, which has potentially catastrophic ramifications for the space-time continuum. The Valyard planned to use this threat to force the Time Lords to give him the Doctor's remaining regenerations, which I don't really understand how that works. If he's the Doctor's final regeneration, how could he exist without those regenerations? I don't understand. this is why I don't like the Valyard. At least as he's presented here, it's just so confusing. The Master revealed that he had been hired by the High Council to murder the Doctor in exchange for a pardon for his crimes against the universe. But he had now decided not to follow through on his mission. The Doctor bluffs his way into the Valyard's TARDIS just as the Valyard opens the time vent door. They struggle and they both fall into the time vent while the Master has Glitz seal the door, saving the universe but trapping the Doctor for all eternity. This, of course, was inspired by the Sherlock Holmes story, The Final Problem, in which Arthur Conan Doyle attempts to kill Sherlock Holmes by having him plunge into a gorge at the Reichenbach Falls in a struggle with Professor Moriarty. Jonathan Turner, Eric Sayward, and Robert Holmes in that early story meeting about the season had agreed to end the season on a dramatic cliffhanger in order to provide a memorable conclusion to what they knew might turn out to be the Doctor's final season. However, in mid-May, Sayward was infuriated to learn that Jonathan Turner had was now having misgivings about the downbeat ending. Nathan Turner had grown concerned that it would provide the BBC with the perfect opportunity to cancel Doctor Who. The Doctor's dead. Why do we need to bring the show back? Mm-hmm. And he felt that the viewers who had followed the season for 14 weeks were owed a genuine conclusion to the story. He also disliked the notion of the Valyard being an evil future Doctor, since this could be seen as wasting one of the Doctor's lives. Furthermore, Jonathan Turner now wanted to reveal that former companion Perry Brown, who was seemingly killed off at the end of the second segment, was actually alive and living happily ever after, married to an oaf.
As a warrior queen.
As a warrior queen. Naturally. Definitely a natural conclusion to Perry's story.
Yeah. Always running a sword through someone, that Perry Brown.
Yes. Eric Sayward reaches out to Jonathan Turner and he is like, please, let's find a compromise. I want to respect Robert Holmes's vision. He's dead. He means so much to the show. He means so much to me. Please, we have to like respect what he wanted. Jonathan Turner, was like, no, absolutely not. He ended up being like, I'm going to rewrite these however I want. Sorry, man, you don't work for the show anymore. And then Jonathan Turner, who was constantly going to Doctor Who conventions, especially in America at this time, every chance that he got, he would badmouth Eric Sayward to fans. And Eric Sayward learned of this. And withdrew his permission for the use of his version of episode 14 from the BBC, which is a thing that writers can do in England that they can't do here in America. So he withdrew it. He's like, you can't use my episode 14. And then he attempted to do the same for his portion of episode 13. But the BBC refused that request on the grounds that it was technically work being performed under Sayward's capacity as a staff script editor, therefore taking away his writing credit from episode 13 and instead returning his script editing credit for episode 13, which he does not have on episodes 9 through 12. With the locations of the final two episodes of the season already scouted and rehearsals set to begin in less than 2 weeks, Jonathan Turner had to act quickly and ask the fastest writers that he knew to finish this story. And so he went to Pip and Jane Baker, who had just written Terror of the Vervoids, and said, look, this is now June 4th. He sends them the script for episode 13. The Bakers in a taxi. And then the next morning he meets with them in the Doctor Who production office, where they were joined by a BBC legal representative who was responsible for ensuring that Jonathan Turner did not divulge any of the contents of Sayward's version of episode 14.
Wow.
Which meant that the Bakers had to come up with their own way of tying everything together. All of the season's loose ends without any knowledge of any original plans for episode 14. So the new season finale was commissioned on June 6th. The Bakers delivered a storyline 3 days later, followed within a week by the completed script, basically like 4 days before shooting was due to begin. Jonathan Turner, acting as script editor, made changes to episode 13 as well as the Baker's final script. This is when the Valyard was redefined as an amalgamation of the Doctor's evil impulses from his own future rather than his final incarnation. The time vent was replaced with the particle disseminator, and instead of the Valyard being weak. Posing as J.J. Chambers, he was now a much stronger figure masquerading as Mr. Popplewick. And it also returned the Master into a more overtly villainous role rather than the sort of like anti-hero version of the character that was intended for the finale. Chris Clough, the director of these six episodes, was really wary of the Bakers episode 14 because when he got the script, he felt that it was too long. And doing the initial run through of it, it was actually 15 minutes too long. Even with numerous cuts made in both rehearsals and post-production, it became clear that there was no way to edit episode 14 down to the required 25 minutes without making the narrative totally incomprehensible because, you know, it's so comprehensible as you get it. Nathan Turner did ask head of drama Jonathan Powell to allocate the broadcast an extra 5 minutes, bringing their time slot to 30. And apparently happy with the way that season 23 had been shaping up so far, Powell agreed. So they got their 30 minutes to wrap this up. So that brings us to the end of production. And the show ends production and the BBC brass had not given any inclination that Doctor Who would be returning for a 24th season. And the whole sort of production team was like kind of down in the dumps because they were like, I think the show's ending. This really sucks. And then on August 13th, an issue, the September 1986 issue of the science fiction magazine Starburst hit the stands, which featured a scathing and detailed interview with Eric Sayward, who gave his side of the story behind his departure from Doctor Who, reserving the harshest criticisms for Jonathan Turner. This was the first time that behind the scenes dirty laundry of the show had ever been aired so publicly. I went and I tracked down this interview and I read the whole thing. And holy shit. I think... I don't, you know, we're not Eric Sayward fans on this show. I think he largely was not a team player, which in many ways, which you kind of like, you don't get to be an auteur and work on a TV show, especially like Doctor Who. You got to work with everybody. However, the light in which he paints Jonathan Turner really depicts him as equally as insane as Eric Sayward. He was going to conventions in America almost every week because of the, you know, money that he would make from these guest appearances. He would not allow any writers to attend these at all because he never wanted any of them to contradict anything that he had to say about how the show was made or make him look bad. He also hated working with experienced directors and writers because they would contradict him and would challenge him, which he despised. Eric Sayward wanted to work with the best of the best because he was like, that's the only way to make this show better and make it last longer is to work with like the best writers and the best directors. And Jonathan Turner always wanted to hire first time directors and first time writers because they were cheaper and easier to work with. He also would do things like a director would come on and would take the staff out to lunch to celebrate a wrap, the staff and cast. And Jonathan Turner would not be invited because Jonathan Turner was rarely on set because Jonathan Turner spent most of his days asleep in his office, usually hung over from some party that he had went to or club that he had gone to the night before. And so he was not invited. And that director was never invited back because he was so offended that that he wasn't invited to this lunch that everyone else was invited to, despite the fact that he had never actually met this guy.
Wow.
Yeah. And in general, it seemed that the disconnect between the two of them was largely a tonal disconnect, which I think is pretty obvious. Jonathan Turner saw the show as a comical children's series, and Eric Sayward was like, no, this is serious, real deal science fiction. And as a result of these two people attempting to work together, we get this sort of bizarre middle ground that makes all of the violence so jarring because everything looks like it's made for a circus, you know? And all of that. He never consulted Eric Sayward on any casting decisions. Everything was forced upon him. You know, things like he did not think that that Colin Baker was a particularly good actor. And what I found was like, I think that Eric Sayward, his writing style specifically, was he talked about how he didn't really like Peter Davison. He didn't think Peter Davison was a very good actor. He didn't really think Colin Baker was a very good actor. He didn't think most of the companions that they had were very good actors. But he loved Tom Baker. And in his limited time on the show during the Tom Baker era, when Jonathan Turner had taken over, Jonathan Turner was constantly telling Tom Baker to just read what's in the script, stop going off script, rein it in, get focused, just do this, just do what's in the script. You son of a bitch. And that is when, you know, that's when Tom Baker ultimately left the show, is because he was like, well, like, I know the doctor. I'm the doctor. I know what he sounds like and how he acts. You're giving me these scripts that are giving me nothing to work with. So I'm making shit up to make the doctor better. And you're telling me to stop it. You just started on the show. I've been on the show since the mid 70s. Mm-hmm. Like, fuck you. You can't tell me what to do. And ultimately quits the show. And Eric Sayward saw that as like the worst thing that like, that just like proof that Jonathan Turner was insane and had this vision of the show that wasn't sustainable. Because he felt that Tom Baker was an incredible actor, and it's because he was able to bring all of this material to scripts that were otherwise kind of basic. And so I think that Eric Sayward's style of writing was very basic. And when he said things like Peter Davison and Colin Baker weren't good actors, it was because they couldn't turn his shit into diamonds.
Right. They weren't good at like improving or like
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Or, you know, just like finding little like quirky things to do or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Tom Baker was. And so that was how he saw the difference. And I think that that total, like, you know, split between these two guys of how they viewed what was best for the show, just ultimately, like, was their downfall. And the interview is fascinating. Like, I don't want to go into all of it. And, you know, it's obviously very one-sided on Eric Saward's side of things. Yeah, it definitely, suddenly it's like, oh, like, yeah, John Nathan Turner certainly was no picnic. So they were just two very difficult men with two very different agendas. Yeah, ultimately, they went their separate ways. And, this interview was a big, big point of gossip when it came out, on August 13th. On August 19th, however, the BBC finally confirmed that the show would be returning for its 24th season. However, it was also learned that, you know, the early episodes of The Trial of a Time Lord debuted to very small audiences when it debuted the following month in September, with viewing figures below even the disappointing range of season 22. And so with that in mind, they're like, something's got to change. We gotta shake things up. So the controller of programs at BBC One, Michael Grade, met with Sydney Newman. Guys, remember Sydney Newman?
Wow.
Yeah. That was, you know, very famously played by Brian Cox in Adventure in Space and Time. He met with Sydney Newman and the former head of drama at the BBC, who spearheaded the creation of Doctor Who in 1963. Newman had written to the BBC on July 16th to inquire as to whether a credit might be added to Doctor Who, which would identify him as its creator. The BBC rejected that request. But Grade seized the opportunity to ask Newman to develop a complete revamp of Doctor Who. So, on October 6th, Newman submitted a formal proposal to Grade's office. He suggested bringing back the second Doctor, Patrick Troughton, to replace Colin Baker, with long-term plans of eventually regenerating the Doctor into a female form. The new companions would be a 12-year-old trumpet player whose instrument could be used as a weapon or to signal the Doctor.
What?
Like the Dragon Zord, I would assume.
that's technically true. A trumpet can be used as a weapon.
Yeah.
And if you were to, like, blow on a trumpet, the Doctor would hear it and be like, oh, it's probably that fucking kid I hang out with with the trumpet.
Yep. A 12-year-old trumpet player and her 18-year-old brother, a graffiti artist who believed the Doctor was out of touch. The Doctor would once again be unable to control the TARDIS as he had been during the Doctor Who's early seasons, but Newman felt the program should rely less on adventures in outer space and more on earthbound narratives. Amongst his suggestions were stories set aboard a NASA space shuttle, a Polaris submarine, an encounter with Christopher Columbus, and a scenario in which the time travelers were miniaturized, similar to 1964's Planet of the Giants, which we just talked about 5 weeks ago. But this time, fighting cancer cells in the body of a young patient.
Shut up. What?
Yes. Grade arranged for a meeting between Newman and Powell to discuss this new take on Doctor Who, and that meeting went poorly. The clash of personalities basically guaranteed that no further action would be taken on Newman's proposal, all except one element. By mid-October, Grade had decided to fire Colin Baker. In a meeting with John Nathan Turner on October 21st, Grade and Powell argued that 3 years was enough for any doctor to portray the character, any actor to portray the doctor, even though Baker had only completed 2 full seasons and had harbored aspirations of breaking Tom Baker's season 7 record. John Nathan Turner was told that he would be moved off Doctor Who at the end of November if and only if he agreed to be the one to break the news to Colin Baker.
That's so... Oh, man.
Although John Nathan Turner objected entirely to their decision, he was relieved that his departure, his own, John Nathan Turner's like departure from the show would be the result of doing this. So he did it. On October 29th, John Nathan Turner calls up Colin Baker and tells him that his time as the Sixth Doctor had come to an end. Colin Baker storms into the head of drama, on November 6th, but, was ultimately unsuccessful in changing Powell's mind. He was, however, offered a contract for a final 4-part adventure, which would climax with the Doctor's regeneration into his 7th incarnation. This was because of John Nathan Turner lobbying for, not completely disrespecting Colin Baker, giving him something to go out on. Colin Baker left agreeing to think about it. Meanwhile, Bonnie Langford... was actually contracted for season 24 on November 13th. So she would continue as the next Doctor's companion on the show. Meanwhile, John Nathan Turner, having done the dirty deed, was preparing himself to finally, at long last, get his wish of leaving this fucking show. he wanted to leave Doctor Who so bad, and he had for so long. But he was trapped because multiple times they had told him, if you leave, we will cancel the show. No one else wants this show, so there's no one else to replace you. If you leave, we will cancel it. So finally, he was going to be able to leave the show. He was talking with multiple soap operas where he was going to take over, like EastEnders or some shit. And he was so excited. And then... on November 28th, he was brought into Jonathan Powell's office, who informed him that not only was he being was his contract being pulled for another year to remain on Doctor Who, but he would also have to cast a new doctor, recruit a new script editor, and develop 14 scripts, all with the start of production 4 months away. Damn. John Nathan Turner was like over, like just like inconsolable and just like absolutely like begging them for more time or to get somebody else. This is impossible. Don't do this. And he was escorted out of Powell's office by security.
Jesus Christ.
Yes. Then. Also, like the next day on November 29th, the first press rumblings about Baker's termination had come out, and the actor himself was finally able to confirm the news on December 18th. By this time, he had presented the BBC with a counter proposal, which would see him record a final season as the Doctor. Otherwise, he feared that his continued attachment to Doctor Who would cost him too much work over the coming 9 months. When the BBC refused, Baker walked away, formally rejecting the offer of a regeneration story on December 19th. Any hope of finding a compromise between Baker and the BBC evaporated on January 6th when the Sun published an extensive interview with Colin Baker talking shit. Expressing his regret at his dismissal from Doctor Who, and speaking scathingly of Powell and Grade, and the cowardly way that he felt he had been treated. So,
Doctor in distress.
That would be that would be it. That's the end of Colin Baker for a good long while. That is how we end up where we end up in this story and eventually Time and the Ronnie in 1987. Rough.
Yep. It's a Scooby-Doo once said.
Yeah, that was a rough one. That was where Scooby-Doo said that was a rough run.
That was a rough run, Raggy.
Rough, rough.
So
I never thought about them driving away post mystery in the van. You're like, oh boy, that one was weird.
Oh my god. So thoughts on all of that.
Just ridiculous.
I mean, it's an epic, you know, it's a saga. Yeah. It's like Hamilton and Burr, you know.
I know. Yeah, where is the like the biopic? Like the
I know.
The dramatized version of this nonsense.
I know. I want Mark Gatiss to write it. I want it to be the sequel to An Adventure in Space and Time, and I want it to be called The Doctor in Distress.
Yeah, this is spicy. Like all
or An Adventure in Space and Time 2, : The Doctor in Distress. Yeah.
A big ugly 2, : Doctor in Distress.
Yeah. And you start with, I think you just start with John Nathan Turner taking over the show in the Fourth Doctor era, and you go all the way through to this.
Wild.
You get a stinger at the end of the teaser where you hint at getting Brian Cox back as Sidney Newman.
Oh, man. Hell yeah. Yeah. I truly think that this would be like, if you're not going to make it about every era, a new adventure in space and time about like literally every era, I feel like this is the story that you tell in that second adventure in space and time, because this is just bananas.
Like a tasteful,
it feels like the ending of
or like
it too,
a tasteful miniseries, you know.
Mm-hmm. True. I'd probably be better as a miniseries, absolutely. But like the idea that like the end, like I'm reading the end of this and I can just picture like him being dragged out of the office and then it freeze frames and then it's like John Nathan Turner continued to be producer on Doctor Who
until
for
like
another
1990
season.
Until the end of Sylvester McCoy's era.
Yeah, to the end of the series, until the cancellation, cancellation in 1989. Like, see, like, the words
mythic.
Coming up on the screen, and, like, yeah, at the end of the biopic miniseries, yeah.
He still couldn't escape.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Oh, man.
That's crazy. Yeah, get, I don't know, get Mr. Darcy to play Eric Sayward. What's that guy's name? Tom Wamsgans.
From Succession.
Deadpool
3.
Yeah. Mark McFadden. That's his name.
He would not be good as Eric Sayward. Gary, he doesn't look anything like Eric Sayward, unfortunately.
I don't know what Eric Sayward looks like.
Yeah. He's very specific looking. Sayward. Yeah.
Paul Giamatti.
That's closer. I'm pretty sure I don't even know that Eric Sayward even worked really after Doctor Who. Like I think he left Doctor Who and then that
it
was like
broke
that was
him.
It for him. Yeah, I think so. Like I think he just, just kept.
He wrote a couple of Target books.
Yeah, but was that after or before?
I don't know. They have like the new cover. Like he has a novelization of Revelation of the Daleks, I think. Mm. So I'm not sure when that was published, but I mean, you know, that's like not new. It's not like post Who work, you could argue. For
sure. Yeah. I just pulled up his IMDb. He literally, his only credit is Doctor Who.
Wow.
It's like Doctor Who. And then he did that K-9 and Company pilot.
Oh God.
Yeah. Mm. And that is it. That's it. That's all he did.
K-9's bastards.
Yeah. Wild. Absolutely wild.
K-9 Hell Company.
Yeah. I like to think that he got like a job at like a TV repair shop or something after this.
Oh, that's even better. Yeah. Like, I was thinking like 80s, like he's parachuting into like Nicaragua, but I like
that. Oh, man. Yeah. So anyway.
Terror of the Vervoids.
I mean, just all of that, like Colin Baker, what they did to Colin Baker. It just,
yeah,
sad stuff, crazy. Man. Yeah. It's a weird, it was a weird time for the show, and it is the time full of drama.
And, you know, we don't know what's going on behind the scenes of the show now, but I don't know, at least the sort of professional airs and public face of the show, you know, I think of like stories in The Guardian of like the three modern showrunners sitting shoulder to shoulder at a table, like smiling and laughing and be like, ah, we fucked up a little bit, but we're still working. And
yeah,
that level of animosity and struggle, the toxicity. It's crazy to think about.
Well, and I think it's a direct result of the way that, you know, BBC ran its shows back then, which is that there was no showrunner. Like, mm-hmm. in modern day context, Eric Saward would be the showrunner, mm-hmm. and John Nathan Turner would be his producer, and the producer's job is to execute the showrunner's vision, right. which is the relationship between showrunner and producer now, currently. You know, your Julie Gardner's, I forget who was the producer during Moffat's era, because it wasn't his wife. She produced all his other stuff. And then Chibnall and his producer. So, like, I think it was just, like, that animosity and that struggle was a power struggle between a person who felt authorship of the thing versus the other person who was like, yeah, but it's my show, mm-hmm. even though I'm not a writer and... you know, I'm just a business guy. It's my show. And so I just think it's just a side effect of like how the show was put together back then. Yeah. I feel like everybody kind of knows their place now, where it's like, oh yeah, like the writer should probably, the showrunner should probably be the lead person behind the scenes on this thing. So anyway, there you go.
Yep.
Weird time.
Pretty weird time. Also, a weird time, Terror of the Vervoids, part 9 of The Trial of a Time Lord. We open on the planet Mogar. Morgar. Morg. Mogar. Mogar. I had to put on subtitles because I thought that he was saying a completely different word at the beginning, and then I was like, oh, I'm going to need subtitles for this one. So it's a planet that has been heavily harvested for its resources by, I think humanity, mm-hmm. spacefaring humanity. Mm-hmm. I think the year is like 2980 or something.
Yeah.
The lion's share of the episode takes place on the Hyperion 3, a super classy, like luxury star cruiser that the Doctor and Mel eventually show up in. First, we're introduced to our gallery, our sort of... you know, Agatha Christie-like rogues gallery of suspects and victims. We have Professor Janet, who also, like Mel, enjoys going to the gym and doing work, low-impact workouts for hours at a time. We meet Security Officer Rudge, who is one day away from retirement. You got a Commodore, you got that nice lady who worked at the front desk, who at one point had to like barricade the doors when the Vervoids were like clawing at them. And I'm like, she's a receptionist. This is crazy.
Yeah. Pip and Jane Baker, they're not great writers. But I will say, I think that like their characters are pretty like solid. Like their character work is like pretty okay. It's their plotting and their story sense that is like, what?
Yeah.
What's going on? Because I genuinely like all the characters here. You know, they're a little two dimensional, I suppose. They're not as like well formed as a Robert Holmes, random character. But as we'll see in the next story. I do like genuinely, I'm like, oh yeah, these are nice. They're better than a lot of other writers' characters, mm-hmm. That are like kind of all the samey, I guess, fit like kind of just archetypes. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Back in the TARDIS, as we alluded to, the Doctor is on a bike and, Perry makes, no, not Perry, Perry's dead. Mel
For now.
For now. Yeah. Mel is like, you know, pointing out the doctor's waistline. And I recently learned that this was like an aspect of like, I don't know, was this like a meta joke in the show? Because apparently there were like fans of the show itself that were like at the time commenting on Colin Baker's appearance and his weight.
That's
so
sus.
I wasn't sure if this was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, just it was, getting it from all sides, catching strays, right. All time of day, Colin Baker. But that being said, yeah, I just found their vibe was just much more playful. And I think I think Mel countered the doctor well in this episode. They come aboard. We meet the doctor recognizes an old face from a past adventure. He's now a commodore of the ship. And he's like, oh, no, you're here. That means people are going to die. There's going to be aliens and stuff. Yeah, I love it's so iconic that Mel is like on a Doctor Who adventure. And she's like, do you guys have a gym? I need to get a workout in.
It's why she got along with Peck so well.
Yeah, that's true. Also cared about his physical, you know.
Yeah. She's like, you, I get. Now you I can get down with. Yeah.
Finally, someone gets it. There's like a mystery afoot. There's been like disappearances happening throughout the ship. And the doctor is very, very reluctant about taking part in any of this business. And Mel is constantly dragging the doctor by the tail into the state of it. Cause he's just like, no, I don't want to get involved. And like it somehow in this story, it worked. Just the kind of anti-doctorness of he's like, no, I don't want to go. I don't want to cause trouble. I just want to walk around and mind my business. And then keeps finding stuff happening. Mm-hmm. He comes across these seeds, the Demeter seeds that the scientists are very keen on. We find out that there's a man named Grenville who is on the ship, and an old man is like, hey, I know you, you're another name. And he goes, you're wrong, and I don't know who you are. The old man's like, I could have sworn I knew that guy from somewhere. And while all this is going on, we are, of course, cutting back and forth to the trial of the Time Lord. Mm-hmm. And my God, these poor actors had to do, how many times have they done the, like, hold on, like the Valyard thing. Oh, doctor, you're doing a thing. Oh, Sektakipa, I can't. Oh. And then the judge would be like, I think you'll both do very well to not be naughty. And then all the chairs will turn around in a wide. And it's like, this has been happening for like 9 goddamn.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just now coming to the full realization that your Colin Baker impression is just James Corden.
Yeah, they're both kind of bratty. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to do. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Good one. Yeah. Good ear.
Oh, God. Is that who you'd have to get to play Colin Baker?
That would Holy be great. Shit. That would be great.
I feel like you'd have to, right? Is there? You'd there's no to. One else. Oh my God!
With the wig, with the curly wig.
Yeah. Oh,
carrot
no.
juice. Oh no!
Oh no! Oh no!
Holy shit!
Oh, that's man. So cursed.
Oh, that's so good.
It's so cursed because it's so perfect. Oh no!
It's like you know it's perfect.
Oh God.
By the way, throughout the story, and I'm pretty sure it's in this episode, I loved the like zoom, really comedic zoom ins of the Sixth Doctor, like eye rolling, like, oh, brother, you know,
uh-huh.
with like a music cue.
Yeah.
So, this episode, part one, the doctor is arguing that the evidence that they've been watching, these visions, I guess, has been tampered with, even though, you know, the Valyard and the judge, what's her name? What's like her title? Stagnia?
Inquisitor? Yeah, or
Inquisitor?
I don't know.
So they're like, well, no, these memories come from the matrix of Time Lord memories and they cannot be tampered with. And he's like, but they are tampered with. I've seen these already. And she's like, what do you mean? They're your future. Mm-hmm. Shut up. And he's all right.
Inquisitor.
The Inquisitor. And the episode ends with, we cut to, I think it's in the isolation room, it's like under a heavy like red light, and we see like this these huge big alien plants pod things, and they start to hatch, and that is the cliffhanger for episode one.
And very specifically, Mel screams, and her direction by John Nathan Turner, who was visiting the set that day, was like, "Oh man, it'd be really great if you could scream in an F sharp, because then we'll be able to transition right into the theme because it'll match. It'll be perfect." So she screamed at an F sharp,
legend,
and that's why that transition works.
So. Bonnie Langford.
Oh, yeah, that one guy gets, like, electrocuted.
Security guy. Yeah. I think his name is Roberts.
Yeah. I always love when the, like, cocky guy in Doctor Who just eats shit immediately.
Oh, did you guys know that Roy Kent is in the Sarunga conundrum?
Yes.
Totally. And that's crazy.
Well, we'll be revisiting him in... You know, yeah. I don't know. Sometimes
really
sure,
everywhere.
I think.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Episode two starts with Mel is brought in for questioning, and there's a big mystery because the body of the security guard that died, and Mel's like, if he hadn't have touched the gate first, like I would have died, and his body's gone. Mm-hmm. And that sort of absolves Mel of guilt because that happened while she was being questioned by the Commodore. God, okay. I can't pinpoint exactly when this is, but there's a moment like when they're being interrogated where Mel's like, well, isn't it obvious what's going on? It's a murder. And the doctor is just like,
yeah.
Yeah. And she said it, you know,
see,
so yeah, there's like missing men. We, like the doctor is like still very like wishy-washy on whether or not he wants to like, get involved with all of this. Is this the episode where they break into that room and they find the missing shoe and then there's another shoe and they think that a guy got like pulverized in the compost?
Yes, I think so.
Decomposter.
Yeah. Right.
The kind of the main antagonist, I guess in retrospect, kind of the red herring is Janet, because the scientists are like clearly scheming and clearly like are keeping secrets from everyone. And Janet appears to be like the mastermind of all of it. But I was actually kind of surprised by how the relationships of the scientists sort of progressed during the story.
Yeah.
We also meet the Morrigans, the natives of the planet that has been heavily harvested for its resources. And they live in these, while they're out on the ship, they have to be encased in these suits because the oxygen is poisonous to them. One of the Morrigans is poisoned, and the doctor reveals that it was the guy that we saw earlier, Melville, who was really this other guy that this was really interesting. The doctor was like, I know this man. He was one of the good ones. Like, they didn't make him like him anymore, but it's like, my understanding is that he's just like a private investigator.
Yeah. He's like, I don't know, like
a Keith Mars.
Would he be like? No, would he be like a like an agent of some kind? Because like at one point they talk about like trying to figure out what he'd been assigned to investigate, and the Commodore is just like, "Oh, it's top secret." And I'm just like, "Okay, so is he like a government guy, or is he like a space government guy?"
Yeah.
Like,
because yeah, I was picturing yeah, like Keith Mars, like a independent PI. Mm. But yeah, you're right. They are kind of alluding to him being like a James Bond kind of type. But the doctor liked him, and it was that murder that really galvanizes the doctor and being like, you know what, that guy was cool. Like, I'm gonna solve this mystery. But all of that is intercut with trial of a Time Lord drama, where he's like, look, you idiots! If you had been actually watching the footage, you would see that Morgan didn't have to press his little translator button before he talked human. So that should have put you. What did you guys think of that? That kind of that little Agatha Christie sort of detective novel play.
I honestly, like, maybe I should have been paying more attention to it, but like I appreciated that they pointed it out because I was just like, oh shit, yeah, he's right. Like
I didn't notice that. I'm like, Hallett. That was his real name, Hallett, the detective agent guy. There's a really interesting scene where they're talking about Hallett, the doctor, and Mel, and they're like leaning against the railing of the ship surrounded by stars, and it's obviously an effect. You can see like the outline of them, but it was like really ambitious for the show for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, that's like an actual visual effect shot. We get some really cool model work in the vein of the iconic opening shot of Trial of a Time Lord coming up that I was a big fan of. I'll say it when we get to it. Because so part two ends with Mel going into the scientist quarters, hearing a noise, opening like a bed chamber thing, and finding a woman with this horrible looking like pod plant effect growing out of her face, and then she wakes up, and that's the cliffhanger.
Can I just say that I think my favorite moment in this story is in episode two, and it's when the two aliens are just vibing in the passenger lounge playing Galaga. High art.
Yes.
Yeah. I loved those guys. Like, they had a case. They were like, you humans, you're fucking up our planet. I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah.
They're good people.
They're good people. So part 11, a.k.a. part 3 of Terror of the Vervoids, opens. The lady with the pod growing on her face tells Mel to stop Larsky, which is Janet's last name, Professor Janet Larsky. They are rushed out of there. I like how just everyone is constantly treating the doctor like an alley cat in this story.
Yeah.
Shoo, get out of here. we learned that the woman in the pod was the an assistant of the scientists named Ruth Baxter. There was an incident while they were doing their science business, and they're keeping her like in a stasis, so that when they get to Earth, they can hopefully cure her of what ails her. This is when the Vervoids really start making their presence known. They start like attacking people, and they shoot them with like these little thorn, like needle things. And yeah, I kind of like, you know, a lot of Doctor Who villains are sort of just like Cybermen with different skins.
Mm-hmm.
And the Vervoids aren't entirely innocent of that, but their theme, their brand, they're kind of like, oh, we're plant-based, we shoot thorns, we like grow pods and stuff. I don't know, I thought the imagery was memorable.
Mm-hmm.
We get the cool Mel gets like knocked out at some point, and she gets thrown in a waste bin, and the doctor has to like race against time to stop her from getting composted. And then his joke at the end is like, don't throw in the towel, Mel.
And just like Chewbacca and C-3PO and the Ugnaughts.
Yeah, absolutely. But that little moment of like, don't throw in the towel, Mel, and her little like, oh, brother, you know, like, thanks, asshole, is just like, you never got that sense of play or fun with Perry and Six.
Mm-hmm.
And
right,
it was fun to see Six getting to kind of be a little bit more charming and loosey-goosey and fun.
Because it was always like Perry that would have the one-liners against the doctor, and the doctor would just be like, fuck you! Like, that would be,
yeah.
She'd be like, don't throw in the towel, doctor. And he's like, what?
You're trying to be funny?
You're trying to be funny, you asshole?
Okay. I'll just shut up, I guess.
All right.
You will. You will shut up.
You'll shut your American mouth.
Yeah, James Corden could be. Yeah. I sent this screen cap to the guys, listeners, but there's a really great moment where all of the Vervoids are gathered around each other, and they're like, we are doing splendidly. And I was like, I like, they do this thing that I was crazy about, where they say things like, if we don't do act now, every Vervoid in existence will cease to exist. And there's like eight of them.
Right?
Yes.
I thought it would be like if the Ninja Turtles would say things like, if we don't do this, every Ninja Turtle on Earth will die.
Right. She's like, because all of them are in this room. Right,
yeah,
now.
You guys. Yeah. You're the Vervoids. So they're doing splendidly. Things are not going well in the trial as things are careening towards, but the doctor keeps insisting that, you know, his memories are being tampered with. Like, you know, there's a moment where Mel's like, okay, doctor, I'm going off to go to the adventures and do something dangerous. And doctor's like, I don't give a shit. Do what you want. And then back in the trial, the doctor's like, I would never say that. Like, why would I do that to Mel? There's stuff about, so Bruckner, one of the scientists, and Janet are having a classic, you know, man was not meant to meddle medley with each other about, like, we made these plants, and they're like, but it could, you know, do good stuff for Earth, but it's killing people. And then, Bruckner, like, attacks Janet, and I was, like, shocked, because I was reading Janet has big, like, you've seen too much, you know, and, like, I thought he was going to kill Bruckner. So when Bruckner, like, knocked her out and ran away, I was, like, shocked out of my stupor, I guess, watching the episode.
Out of your Jesus Christ, another episode of Doctor Who stupor.
I was like, oh, I didn't see that coming. That's cool. And the Vervoids are like, well, Bruckner is now our top target because he wants to destroy us. So, like, we have to kill Bruckner. Bruckner takes control of the ship at that point and careens it into a beautifully animated late 80s black hole. With teeth, right? Mm-hmm. It looked like it had teeth.
Yeah. There was like a bunch of like geometric patterns and like red and like silver light. And he's just like staring into this void. And I'm like, man, this is so stupid. Yeah. I love it.
The cliffhanger is like the ship rumbles and Janet's like, what was that? And the doctor's like, isn't it obvious? He's just taking us into the black hole of Tartarus. And that's the... Yeah, and I was like, man, Doctor Who Into the Black Hole of Tartarus is kind of a hard title. Yeah. Our fourth and final, please.
That could also be the name of the subtitle to Adventure in Space and Time 2.
It's The Black Hole of Tartarus.
Starring James Corden as
Colin Baker.
It's just the guy playing John Nathan Turner, like pulling at his hair, like David Lynch.
Oh, my God.
My mind. I want to write on a soap opera. It's more chill than this. Part 12 is we get a sudden turn of events. Rudge, security officer Rudge, who was one day from retirement, has aligned himself with the Morgians to hijack the ship. They're like, I'm sick of your shit. I'm sick of people stepping on me. And this is like unrelated to the murders that have been going on. This is just like a whole different side plot. So they take the doctor and some people hostage, but Mel is able to escape. The Morgians are mysteriously killed by someone throwing water on them.
Mm-hmm.
I thought both Morgian actors really acted the hell out of that. Mm. What did you guys think of their face reveal when Mel pulls off their masks and we see that they have like a filter like over their mouths, like a fireplace?
Yeah, they have like. But it's like part of their face, right? It's like part of the skin.
Yeah, it's like organic. Yeah.
It looks like the filter on their masks, but it's like on their face. It's really weird.
So we learned the culprit, the murderer. I'll be honest, I didn't write his name down. But he's the guy that was in Brown.
The third scientist guy.
The third scientist, yeah, the one that wasn't Janet or Bruckner. So. Mm. And he has this big argument with the doctor where he's like, look, those Vervoids are the shit. We can grow them and they're strong and we can be like, it's labor. It's free labor. And the doctor's like, it's slave labor. Like, you're breeding plant slaves. That's not cool, man. And the doctor's like, Rome was built by slaves. And the doctor's like, yeah. Didn't end well for the Romans. Not a good look, bro. And the Vervoids, they can hear all of this through the speaker, I guess, of the room that the third scientist and the doctor are in. And they're like, we don't want to be slaves. Like, that sucks. So, like, they attack him. And there is some really good doctor business in this episode where Mel finds, like, a pile of bodies that the Vervoids have been, like, collecting. And she's, you know, super distressed and disturbed by it. And the doctor, like, comforts her, but is like, hey, like, what do you do with your weeds in your garden back home? And she's like, well, I put them in a compost pile. And she's like, he's like, you have to understand that's what they think they're doing. I think the word was like a compulsive following of the life cycle. And I don't know. I just found that to be a uniquely doctor way of, like, he would kind of be able to take a step back and see the kind of the logic of what these creatures are doing, even though it is horrific.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, good bit of doctor business. So they, yeah, they have this interesting line where they're like, animal kind. We have to stop animal kind, the Vervoid say, and the doctor's like, oh yeah, from their perspective, like, we humans from any, at some point, a human will consume plant life, or any animal will consume plant life. So like, they see us as an existential threat. We can't even argue that they're wrong. And the Commodore is like, so you agree, like, there's no justice in this. Like, we have to kill them because they're going to kill us. Or if they get back to Earth, you know, we have to kill all of them. And then the doctor pauses the footage in the trial and he's like, see, the dude asked me to help. He said, I want you to intervene. So I intervened. I did not meddle. I intervened at when, and no, there was no other option. And the Valyard spins that into, well, it sounds like you killed all of the Vervoids. So that's a genocide. Rule 7 of being a Gallifreyan is don't do a genocide. You're guilty. And that's how it ends.
Good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we get like an act out where, you know, they get into the TARDIS and he's like, I'm a bad singer. And I was like, you sure are, idiot. And they fade out.
I'm very excited for Nick to hear Colin Baker sing in one of those Big Finish audios.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, yeah. He has that song that's like the running joke that he has this one song that he sings very badly, but with great enthusiasm,
mm-hmm.
as Oscar Wilde once wrote. Terror of the Vervoids. Yeah. Fun, right?
Yeah, I think mostly. Generally. Yeah. Yeah. Especially as far as Six Doctor.
Right? Yeah.
TV like, stories are concerned. It's kind of, we're grading it on a yeah. curve. Like, but it might very actually, well be his like second best story.
Like, I was actually charmed by a lot of this, which is not the yeah. emotion I'm used to feeling whenever we get to Six Doctor
right.
episodes.
Right. Because it's mostly like discomfort. Right. You should...
yeah. yeah.
I'm like, God, why is he yeah. yelling at that poor yeah. woman? Yeah.
You're right, this guy. You described it really well earlier. It is the juxtaposition of the child fairy tale like garishness with the shocking kind of moments of violence and blood and mm-hmm. meanness. I mean, Perry's quote, death is like one of the meanest things to happen in the show up to mm-hmm. that point.
Yeah. Oh, easily. Yeah. Yeah. So is her ultimate fate, really.
married to an oaf. Which brings us at last to the final two parts of a Trial of a Time Lord, the ultimate foe.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Yes. So, you're yeah. going to have to bear with me because a lot happens in this, but also not a lot happens in this at all. The Doctor is now on trial, I guess, for doing a genocide. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on top of that, he still is adamant that his evidence, the story that we just watched, The Terror of the Vervoids, has been tampered with. And they bring out this Time Lord guy, and he's like the keeper of the Matrix key. And he's just mm-hmm. like, look, dude, like, you can't tamper with the Matrix. You need this key that I wear around my neck. And the doctor's just like, yeah, but like, who has access to that? And the keeper is just like, oh, you know, just the normal people who have access to it. So they're arguing this, and these two, I guess, like, time travel pods, like, they're like one passenger yeah. pods. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dock at the station, and they open, and out of one comes Mel, and then out of the other comes our dear friend Savalom Glitz. Yeah. And they're like, who the hell are you? They go to the trial to you know, like back up their friend, the doctor, even though the doctor technically hasn't met Mel yet. And they're like, oh yeah, no, like we were sent for, and the doctor's just like, or everyone is just like, who sent for you? And then lo and behold, the master makes himself known on the screen, and it's just like, oh, it is I, the master. I did this.
And the doctor's like, oh, yeah.
No.
Not this son of a bitch.
And he's like, I did this because I don't want to let the Valyard win. And they're like, oh, okay, that's weird. So
I thought it was weird for me as a new Who person, and that was my entry point. It was interesting that none of them knew who the master was.
Like none of the Time Lords, like, you mean?
Yeah. They're like, who are you? And he's like, I am called the Master. I'm like, ooh, I bet. I would have expected like, oh, it's this guy. We all know who this guy is. Just jerk off.
I don't remember the state of like the left from like the last time the Master messed up Gallifrey. So, but
that's true.
So the Valyard is ultimately revealed to be this personification, like the amalgamation of the Doctor's evil impulses from his future. It's like between his 12th and final like regenerations, like we mentioned earlier. There is a conspiracy that Sebalom Glitz talks about, how the High Council of the Time Lords offered the Valyard the Doctor's remaining regenerations if he convicts the Doctor of bullshit, of like what he's been on trial for. And because the High Council is trying to cover up the fact that they pull Earth out of like the mysterious planet from the first part of this season, was the High Council's doing. Like, so they themselves were meddling and like doing terrible things.
This goes all the way to the top.
Yeah. So it's a cover up. And the Valyard like runs away into the Matrix. And the Doctor goes to follow, and Mel's like, well, I'm coming with you. And the Doctor's like, no, absolutely not. I'm going to take this asshole. So he and Sebalom Glitz go in. They find themselves in.
Before we get to the Matrix, though, I just want to point out that, like, at this point, we're 10 minutes into the episode and we're just now leaving the courtroom.
Yes.
I felt exhilarated.
Yeah, I know.
When they run out of the courtroom, after like, you know, the four episodes of Vervoids, I was like, oh shit. Like, we're cooking now. They're out of the courtroom.
Yeah. they're getting to the bottom of this shit.
No more like turning all the chairs around and watching TV.
Right?
there's still quite a bit of that.
That's true. That's very true.
So they go into the Matrix and they are in this like Victorian London kind of esque thing, which I imagine is the remnants of like all the Jack the Ripper stuff from the first draft of the script.
You're right. Wow.
They meet they go to this place called the Fantasy Factory. None of this is elaborated on. It just kind of happens.
Like Dream Lodge almost.
Oh my God. You know what? Oh my God. Eric Sayward is so stupid. I just figured out what Robert Holmes was doing.
Oh yeah?
With the Jack the Ripper stuff.
Oh, because JJ.
Because the two guys who were real life possible like suspects for Jack the Ripper see him inside the Matrix and is like, you're Jack the Ripper. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. That was gonna be the big reveal, was that the Valyard, who is the Doctor, was gonna end up being Jack the Ripper.
Oh.
Guarantee you that's where that was going.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the Doctor's Merlin and Jack the Ripper.
Love that.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like the idea of like, or Valyard was going to be like abandoned in Victorian London with no powers and then would become Jack the Ripper or something like that. Ooh. But like, there was definitely going to be something to do with the Valyard being Jack the Ripper somewhere. Without a doubt.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I fully feel like that's where that was going. That's what that was setting up. Cause like, why else would they accuse the Doctor of being Jack the Ripper?
Right.
Unless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have either of you ever read From Hell?
I tried to. Long time ago.
I've also seen the movie.
Oof.
I've heard the book is like exhaustively researched.
It is. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's also very long.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. But and the movie is.
Yeah.
It's
I like I liked when Sal Blomkvist gets fucking stabbed with a
spear. Yeah, he gets like a harpoon launched into his chest.
Yeah.
And so they're wandering around this Victorian London area of the Matrix, and like it's very dream logic, like nothing is real. They go the episode ends with the Doctor like falling into like quicksand, like being pulled into quicksand by these like disembodied hands, which is like genuinely scary. There's also a moment where he like is pulled into a barrel of water by a disembodied hand.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that disembodied hands, man, I guess it's like really scary.
Like it activated new fear.
Yeah.
Activated,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. New
like,
fear unlocked. Mm-hmm. Also in this episode, we learn that, Perry did not die. She has in fact acquired a himbo warrior husband and is now, I don't know, I guess just living her life.
Yeah. I like that they didn't have any new footage. So they just like fan vid old footage that was like from
like
the show.
It's like a fan cam of like Perry with this kid.
Yeah. Yeah. The one time that he touched her in any way. Yeah.
Just 1,000 years by Christina Perry kind of playing.
Yeah. Right.
Oh my god.
I like how the Inquisitor
as you can
was,
see
like...
Doctor in this fan cam she actually lived happily ever after.
Here's every time they shared a frame together.
She loves that oaf.
I mean, it, you know, as it hackneyed and awkward as it is, I was kind of elated that that wasn't actually the canonical end for Perry because, you know, like we said, it was like weirdly savage and unpleasant for a pretty beleaguered character.
Mm-hmm. Instead, she becomes the Wilma to some dude's Fred Flintstone.
See, I thought I went more Fiona Shrek.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Warrior queen, loyal oaf.
Yeah. Okay.
There you go.
Sabalom Glitz is kind of donkey-esque.
Yeah, he kind of is.
That's true. It's interesting, like two companions in a row have their like kind of happily ever after. I mean, we later found out like just recently what ended up with Mel, but like the fact that it was like, yeah, we have Perry who ends up with that idiot from Mind Warp, and then Mel ends up leaving the show with Sabalom Glitz, like to go travel the stars with him.
That's a big red flag.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh, I just remembered. Yes, Sabalom Glitz gets a shout out in the giggle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he sure does. He sure does. And it was a full circle moment for my life.
Right.
Personally.
Yeah.
I was like, yes.
I like stood up and pointed at the screen. Yeah.
Finally, I am complete. I have heard his name uttered on a new episode of Doctor Who. Now, if somebody could say Pex, that's when like, now I'm done. That's it.
Yeah. Like if 15 alludes that he and Pex like hooked up once.
Yeah. Cass is like losing
it. Oh my god.
It.
Jesus Christ. Oh my god.
I bet David Tennant did have a little nerd out though when he was like, oh my god, I get to say Sabalom Glitz in an episode. Or no, I guess Mel says it.
Yeah, Mel said it. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh man.
So
yes.
This is where we get Screenception.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Where?
In the last episode, right? Because she
yeah.
The doctor is like he suddenly like ascends from the quicksand because like nothing makes any sense here. The Valyard shows up. They banter.
Can we just talk about the quicksand
sure.
for a minute? Because seeing Colin Baker roll around on what is obviously wood with a bunch of sand covering the wood so that the hands have something to like poke through, you know, because they're obviously not really on in sand. And then just like really roughly cut to him, like in a bathtub full of sand, like dip falling into the quicksand. Like it was just so, while the hands are like next to it, still under the wood. It was just like, I was like, man, wow. They weren't even trying to hide what this was. This is amazing.
And then the effect of him rising out of it is
yeah,
startling. Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. Oh, man.
I like that Sabalam Glitz was like fully like robbing the doctor in the seconds that he thought he was dead.
Mm-hmm. Time to loot the body. Oh, well, he's dead.
Oh, yeah. Very sad.
So there's like a cloud of poisonous gas that just appears. So the doctor and Glitz, they like run into like a little beach shack, and then it turns out to be the Master's TARDIS. How the Master's TARDIS has ended up in the Matrix is not relevant, I guess. The Master is basically like, hey, we got to take the Valyard out because I need to be the most evil person in the room. So this is where I have trouble. Because I know where this episode ends with the Valyard seemingly defeated. But then he turns out to be the keeper of the Matrix guy in the courtroom.
Right.
And everything that happens in this episode is like honestly like a fever dream. Like the Master is there, the Valyard's there, they have to stop something from blowing up. Why? I don't know.
Mr. Popplewick is really the Valyard in disguise.
Yeah. There's like this whole thing with like the bureaucracy of this this person they're trying to see. It's all very muddled.
Yeah. They asked the doctor to run for president again.
That's like a long standing gag though. Like
he's like the Rock.
We just put you on trial that would have resulted in the end of all of your lives. However, now that that's over, we would love for you to run for president.
Well, because, like, I don't know, because the High Council has been, like, deposed or whatever because they're, like, a bunch of shady assholes. But, like, it's like, Doctor, will you be president again? It's like, no.
So in this, we get the, like, false trial where the doctor is put to death. And there's this really funny moment where Mel's like, no, like it's fake. They were appealing to the doctor's sense of drama and romance. And cut to him being on a coach being driven to his execution. And he starts quoting A Tale of Two Cities. And it was just a great little moment of like the companion, like really knowing the doctor too well. And because I had that thought of like, oh my god, is he gonna do Tale of Two Cities? And then he did.
I also loved the Popplewick Valyard mask pull reveal.
It's great.
That was actually like pretty well done, all things considered. It was good. I loved that.
I understand why the Master wants this guy gone, because like that's the Master's shtick. Like he's the disguise guy, right? Like,
yeah. He's like, whoa, no competition, okay?
Which is a really interesting observation that you know, a composite of the Doctor's darkest thoughts, as the Valiant is described, ends up being a character that has a lot of similarities with the Master.
That's true. I just like the idea of the Master being like, yo, you don't get to be me. Papa Wick isn't even an anagram of Valyard. Get the hell out of here. You don't know what you're doing.
You're horrible at this.
Yeah, what else happens in this?
Time Lord President. Yeah, this is the last we see of Colin Baker. Pretty crazy.
Yep. Yeah, last thing we hear him say is carrot juice, carrot juice, carrot juice.
Yep.
It's the last thing.
I don't want to go say on
television and tell Power of the Doctor. Was that the
finally
last thing he ever said until Holy Power of the crap. Doctor. Yeah. Does he reference carrot juice in that? He must have, right?
I feel like he did.
Right? Mel's
yeah,
right
Mel's
there.
Right there. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
<Easy. laughs>
boy, what a ride it's been, this trial of this Time Lord.
Yeah, what a trial it was. Two seasons of it, really.
And it was just the Doctor just jerking himself around.
Yeah, it's true. Some kind of weird amalgam guy. Yeah.
So it sounds like Scott, you're lukewarm at the idea of the Valyard coming back in New Who.
I'm not opposed to it happening if it's done well and with purpose. But I'm not into the idea of it happening just for the sake of it happening, I guess.
Sure. Like with the weight and kind of intelligence that the Toymaker's Return had.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And it would have to be, I feel like the Valyard could only come back in an anniversary special or regeneration episode of some sort. Like
the 70th.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to see the Valyard just be like some random villain at the end of a random season.
Weird.
You know? I feel like that would be really weird. I feel like he's only appropriate in that context. So yeah, I would be into it. Honestly, I think they missed the mark with the Celestial Toymaker. I feel like that should have been the Valyard because he literally puts the Doctor on trial at a certain point. Yeah. I feel like that could have been a really cool pull of like really finally paying off the Valyard. Or even retconning the Valyard as the Celestial Toymaker or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a line the Toymaker has at one point. I can't remember it exactly, but he's like, I've made a puzzle of your history. Mm-hmm. Sort of maybe like a half, like an escape valve of like, yeah, any kind of weird continuity mishap or smush up that happens, that's just because of the Toymaker.
Right. Yeah. 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 I would be totally fine if they had retconned the Valyard as actually being the Celestial Toymaker. I'd have been like, yeah, that makes more sense than what they tried to explain to us it was.
Yeah, I feel like that, especially for like when they're trying to relaunch the show to new audiences, like that's way too in the weeds. Like we would have loved that, but like, yeah.
That's true. But there's a few, like, I feel like there's a few weird, like, continuity. I mean, it was for the 60th anniversary, you know, so... But there's a few continuity things because there's that guy in my favorite episode of the Troughton era who is called the Master, but is not the Master. And that would have been fun to reveal that that was also the Celestial Toymaker, you know? I don't know. You could have cleaned up some stuff by just being like, yeah, it was him the whole time. You thought you haven't seen him since the first one? Well, actually, he was this guy and this guy and this guy. Like that would have been kind of fun. I don't know. Probably would have made a lot of like, old school Who fans very, very angry, though, to see that kind of retcon. But I don't know
how many of them.
I think that would have been fun, especially for a 60th anniversary thing.
Yeah, what a ride. What a wild ride, like Mr. Toad through hell itself.
Oh, that was the other rumor, was that the War Doctor was going to end up being the Valyard. That was the other one. I knew I was forgetting one. That was the other one that was running rampant. Yeah. Yeah.
He kind of is.
I mean, kind of, yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, he's like, I'm gonna commit a genocide.
Right. What is that called? Double jeopardy? You're like, double jeopardy. You can't try me for this one. You already tried me for that other one.
You can't try me for a genocide. I've already got a genocide. Double jeopardy, idiots. He's right.
God damn it, he's right. anyway, so ends the television era of Colin Baker. Next time we'll have a one-off adventure, a Big Finish adventure with him and Penguin. That'll be on the next round, and it'll be our first foray into Big Finish Sixth Doctor stuff. Before jumping headfirst into Evelyn, who is
she's
the
so
best.
Cool.
She's so cool. Evelyn's the best.
I'm excited.
So anyway, that's it. Next week we're back with a much shorter story, the Seventh Doctor story, Ghost Light, which is largely considered, you know, kind of top tier. Sylvester McCoy. I mean, we're in kind of like the strongest part of his era. So at this point, it's sort of like a
return
of
Ace.
Really good episodes. Yep, of course. Yeah, more Ace, more Seventh Doctor, haunted, spooky house stuff. Only three episodes long.
Yeah.
Bring it.
Cakewalk.
Yeah. Bring it. All right. We'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.